your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there. Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. Take second best, put me to the test. Things on your chest, you need to confess. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith.
I don't know what you guys have any thoughts on that.
Personal.
Oh, I have so many thoughts on Jesus. What you said there. It's, you know,
I just think you raise a good point. I don't really have anything to add to all of that, but.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It makes it really challenging sometimes because things aren't as black and white. And I look at Christianity and I see something that's actually joked about in Judaism quite a bit. Well, from the text that I've looked at in Hebrew in commentary on the Zohar, when the subject of the goat comes up, that you tie a ribbon to a goat. And you tie a red ribbon to a goat, and you tie a red ribbon to your door, or the door of the temple, and you literally, you kill the goat by pushing him off of a cliff. And if a certain amount of time goes by, and the ribbon on your door has turned white, then you know that your sins have been, that your sins left with the goat. This is the sacrifice for... your transgressions.
It's a scapegoat, right?
Yes, it's where the term scapegoat comes from, and it's the basis of Christianity, gospel Christianity. And there's aspects there that you can see where they came from in Judaism, but I definitely really resonate with the idea that Jesus, especially when you look at the Nag Hammadi, is kind of more of a composite of mystery schools, and that a lot of the things that he's presenting are also very like Egyptian in origin, and I mean, which makes sense. I mean, he goes to Egypt in the beginning of the gospel, you know, he's raised in Egypt essentially, and he's you can see the lineage and what's being communicated there. But I just really feel like people are really quick to because we're in a compartmentalized, we're kind of conditioned to compartmentalize, that we apply that to just about everything, and there's this assumption that these schools aren't connected, and the fact of the matter most likely is that they're far more connected than we normally are willing to acknowledge, and just because that's what we do, we separate out the schools, we love to do that, and I believe in kind of a grand unified field theory of religion, which is, I would call myself more theosophical than anything because of that. I don't, it seems like just the logical thing to do. And it seems like what Christianity's intention was kind of to do, or inevitably ended up doing, so.
Well, you spoke of Joseph Atwill, and I've spoken with him. I've actually interviewed him a few times, and I have talked to him on just one-on-one on the phone several times as well. He's also associated with Jan Ervin, and they've done some interesting research. I find his research fascinating, and I find it remarkable that it's like it's almost like playing Obama's Yes We Can backwards, and he says, thank you, Satan. It's right. Like, it just happens that way. I don't know how come that happens, but I can hear it too.
Right.
When you play it backwards, it just manifested that, like, you know, a Beatles song or something. It's like this strange way that a person, he applies a key, which, you know, he calls typography, that has to do with this form of writing that is allegorical. And he comes up with this, you know, solution that's really remarkable, interesting, and somewhat convincing. But I'm with you in my sort of skeptic, I have reserved skepticism about the final conclusions that he reaches.
He bulked up his book, you know, and I don't feel like his extrapolations are as logical as his like initial premise, because he has an initial argument, and instead of just leaving it at that, he goes on with all these different ideas and then tends to veer away from presenting them as possibilities, but rather asserts them as this has got to be what it is. And that's basically the point is with probability theory and the way that he utilizes it, which is incredible, is he shows a parallel between Josephus Flavius, a Jew captured by the Romans and adopted into the Flavian court, and the only person to have written history of that time other than a Roman botanist, right? So everything else is destroyed. So, you know, that there is correspondences that are like off the charts, uncanny, between the works of Josephus and specifically the first four books of the New Testament. He doesn't go into anything else. So, that parallel is something to take note of. Does it mean that everything that he's building on top of that is absolute? He presents it like it is, but that doesn't feel like real logic to me. The first part does. But then it should be left to the individual to extrapolate what that means more, I guess. I don't know.
I would agree with you. I totally would agree. You know, but to sort of bring it back around to this, the Gospel of Thomas, because that's the focus of this conversation, you know, and the material that Swami has put together with the help of Alan and the Team Sync book, right? And so
it's all good. Actually, Joseph Atwell is mentioned in here.
Yeah, he is in the book. I remember that you do cover that right early on, Swami. You kind of sound off as well, and you kind of take the same position we're sort of presenting here as well, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, and I was really just addressing one contention that I heard him make. It was on your show, actually, Frater, he was really dismissive of the of the potential, because his assertion, for people that aren't familiar, or one of his assertions at least, is that Jesus is a completely fictional entity devised by the Roman state as a psyop. And he cites, based on what I know, he invokes Josephus to back that statement, and I've read Josephus, and that does not that was not my take on on that material at all. You guys have obviously studied what he has to say at greater length than I have, and that's kind of that kind of makes me feel a little vindicated not having really gone into depth in that, but in the book I do address that one point, and I basically just said no, I don't come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, you know, I think that I suspect that he was actually, I believe he told me, he was Jesuit trained overseas through like the Foreign Service, like his family might have been involved in, you know, like ambassadorship or something, because I believe he was Jesuit trained. He went to a school for American kids who were like GI on a base or whatever, right? So I think that he has sort of a pendulum shift kind of reaction to Christianity, maybe. From my own personal, I mean, I'm just throwing that out there because I've talked to him one-on-one, and he's that way, the way you said, he's sort of dismissive about everything that we're talking about with regards to reading into another alternative, an alternate teaching that Well, you know, it's clearly there. I mean, anybody who studies the New Testament can clearly identify key places where you're experiencing two different shifts between two different teachings. And the, you know, one is the works of Paul, who never met Jesus, who's first preached the doctrine that Jesus was divine, which would have been considered blasphemous to Jesus' own followers, Orthodox Jews, who absolutely venerated the laws of Moses, which strictly prohibited the ingestion of blood in any form, by the way, all means of, you know, it was all about the kosher meant ritualistic killing with blood being drained out. As a, you know, anybody, it's easy to find that out. That's what that means. And even the idea of allegorically doing that, consuming blood, would have been something that, according to those times, would have been a breach of the covenant with Almighty God, you know. And Paul's gospel suggested that Christ died for our sins, which, you know, again, since the staying of Abraham's hand, you know, his knife wielding against his own son Isaac on the altar of sacrifice, the notion of human sacrifice was for the forgiveness of sins would have been considered completely sinful, you know, blasphemous. And to those people of those movements, they would have thought that to be, I mean, based on my understanding of the idea of what these people believed and the works that are laid out in the community rule that's right there in the Dead Sea Scrolls for the Qumran monastery, as well as the works that are found in the Nag Hammadi, I believe they point to the same thing. And yet this kind of approach would have been totally in keeping with the Greeks and Romans who Paul was supposedly pitching his gospel to, you know, and to them, the idea of a noble sacrifice, the idea of a concept of a deification of an extraordinary human being would have been totally accepted without question. Paul's message, his doctrine of that would have been fine. But see, his point was, is that it was a faith-based salvation without good works, meaning that it was founded on the faith and the principles of original sin and a human blood sacrifice. And that stood in stark contrast to an aesthetic gospel message of a yogic way of liberation from suffering and sin that was the real through realization and right action. Am I mistaken?
Well, I think I'd like to just you could have said all that, and I would have said, yeah, exactly, nothing to add. The conclusion, basically, that you arrive at, that the conclusions that are popularly built around Paul, modern Orthodox Christianity, basically, let me rephrase. There are different interpretations of Paul, and I think that distinction is important to make, because there were Gnostics like the Valentinians and the Marcosians, and they highly venerated Paul, and they were in it for Gnosis and nothing less. And they basically, their contention was basically that Paul was some kind of genius, enlightened master, and that he was speaking to both the animal or dualistic Christians, the one that didn't have the capacity to even have the goal of shooting for enlightenment, and then the psychic Christians, or the ones who were approaching it from the perspective of Advaita, or at least trying to realize Advaita or non-duality. And so there are, whether or not their contention is true, I don't know. But I just think it's, and I have to credit Jason Barrera for pointing this out to me, because I was, the first version of the book, before I showed it to him, I was talking about Paul in exactly the same way that you R. Frater, and I think that and what I ended up doing is just revising it to show the other perspective, and that there are two interpretations of Paul. And the interpretation of Paul that you're talking about, Frater, it doesn't really have any scriptural precedent if we follow it back to the source.
Well, I mean, I guess I would respectfully disagree right there, but you're also betraying my bias against Paul, because I have studied his epistles closely and can, I don't have it right here in front of me, but we could talk more about it. I could totally, you know, map out my contention as far as the claims that are made in his letters. But, you know, aside from that, you know, it's, once again,
goes back to, sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to add, it kind of, for me, it goes back to the question of historical accuracy. Is it historically accurate? I'm not saying it is. I'm willing to concede. I'd like to talk about it more, actually, but it wouldn't really affect what I get from the subject matter to concede that, that you're right in terms of historical accuracy. But I do think I do think that people are definitely getting value from his teachings from a Gnostic standpoint. I mean, historically, that's kind of been demonstrated by, like, Elaine Pagel's Gnostic Paul. I mean, there were the people who were interpreting him that way, and they did get some value out of it. And it's the same thing, it's kind of the same conclusion that I came to in reference to Joseph Atwill's contention that there is no historical Jesus, he's a fabrication. In that case, I'm inclined to believe there was a guy named Jesus. Maybe there wasn't. The teachings are there, and the teachings do what they say they do. You know, it's an experiential thing, and I think that's where that's where the real merit is.
Well, okay, so at the risk of digressing completely away from the point, I mean, to raise Elaine Pagel's doesn't really hold a lot of water with me, because I disagree with her about a bunch of stuff with her interpretation of the Gnostic material, number one. Number two, when you want to refer to historical accuracy, I'm drawing directly upon the letters of Paul in the New Testament. I don't know how much more historical, and then we can draw from the Pseudo-Clementines of Clement, and then we can draw from Eusebius and Josephus, and we find, when you talk about the effect, let's talk about the history of how his words were interpreted with, for example, St. Augustine, and then, you know, all of the the Crusades and the suppressions of the, you know, genocidal of the Cathars, and even up into modern times. I mean, it's for me, it's a no-brainer. So it's sort of a digression. But
well, we don't have Jason Barrera here right now.
Right, I know. I wish he was. I thought he was gonna be.
I can tell you, there hasn't been like a single incident where he's put something out there and I've cross-referenced it, and then I'm just like, wow, he's repeatedly blown my mind and corrected me, and I'm grateful for those corrections. Because he's pretty fucking on it.
See, it sounds like a part two to this talk. We should definitely line that up, because
absolutely. You know, we kind of put today's show together a little last minute, but I had wanted to see if we can grab him. So I definitely would want to do this again with him here. Especially, he worked so damn hard on this book, and definitely had a lot to contribute as far as other points of view and just different research. I just want, while we're sort of on this quasi-political concept, I just want to ask this question. So we're sort of talking about how we have the canon being possibly influenced and manipulated, and the Gospel of Thomas as being something distinct. But we do have Gospel of Thomas, Logion 100, does repeat the idea of render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and paying taxes, so that also makes it into here. And there is one particular logion that I can't kind of shake, this really funny, to me it's a synchronicity, it's not necessarily a manipulation, but it's something that I can't shake. Logion 100, it says, Jesus said, the realm is like a shepherd who had 100 sheep. The largest one of them wandered off. The shepherd left the 99 sheep and searched for that one until he found it. After he had gone to such trouble, he said to the sheep, I care for you more than the 99. Now, in our modern day, we have the Occupy Wall Street movement, which makes the point that we are the 99% and the elite are the 1%. And here we have this whole section about going on about how the 99, screw the 99, I care about the 1. And now, obviously, Swami, you know, applying Swami's interpretation of this actually would even put that into a proper context, because he talks about the idea that the 99 are kind of already taken care of. They're the ones who aren't lost, right? These could be 99 devout or somewhat more pure souls, and the one that could potentially be lost or stray is where God needs to put the attention to sort of bring back into the fold and things like that. And that could perfectly well apply to if we wanted to go that route. But again, just the sort of, whether it be a synchronicity or a funny correlation, I just wanted to throw that out there and see what you guys thought of that.
Oh, I'm so glad you reminded me of that, the whole Render of Caesar thing, because that was one of the things that David had mentioned that I'd forgotten in the interim of coming up with other responses to more things he was saying. But the whole idea of Render onto Caesar, I mean, if there is anything that just smells of total deliberate agenda, it's that point. And you make such a great point that, I mean, we can make all these claims about historicity and accuracy and authenticity of the Dead Sea Scroll Nag Hammadi fragments. They were held back for so long. They were manipulated by the church and other leaders. I mean, they were translated and you know, written and rewritten. So who knows what is real and what isn't? It's all suspect in the bottom line. You know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned. But I wanted to address one thing that Swami mentioned, which he said that he derived from talking with Jason, which hopefully we'll talk to again, and the teachings that could be considered, you know, edifying and that could be considered proto-Gnostic or pseudo-Gnostic or whatever. I'm just using that term to look at that sort of like the logic teaching that's there and the Gnostic symbolism that you mention in your book, the things that you quote that are, you know, clearly reminiscent of applied practical teachings, of applied understandings that are based on the same, you know, ancient Enlightenment traditions, right?
Yeah, that is in there.
And that's what I wanted to point out, is I can definitely agree with that. I can see how that within the works of Paul, and I've already come to that conclusion myself. As I said, I studied the epistles closely, and woven in there, aside from his constant need to justify himself and put off all the detractors that seem to be heaped up against him from all directions, especially the leadership from Jerusalem. But besides that, he clearly is putting forth a Gnostic-like philosophy or a, you know, what you could kind of marry it to the Gospel of John and the books of John in the New Testament. There's a sort of theology that's sort of distinct, that stands alone, you know, a wisdom teaching, if you will.
So what was, I'm sorry, did I
well,
miss
I was just sort of, no, I wasn't really throwing a question out there. I was just kind of pointing out that I can kind of see, I'm not, when I, my prejudice towards Paul is personal because of the way that I was presented with his works and then the way that I interpreted them later on after experience and investigation. But I'm not completely blind to or completely ignorant to the inherent edifying qualities within the works, that there is a teaching in there, is what I'm trying to say.
Gotcha. Yeah,
you know, a stopped clock is right twice a day too, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great, Alan. And too, I really appreciate the fact that you know, the idea of the contention that's laid right in the work, the Gospel of Thomas, of render to Caesar, you know what I mean? So it's still the political agenda, you know, and now a word from our sponsor, the Flavians.
I mean, I have to wonder about that. This is something that I, you know, I have to admit, this is the paranoid conspiracy part of me. Every now and then kind of pops up with the Gnostic text. It's fairly irrational, but I just have to say, is that, you know, here we are in a century of, you know, unparalleled propaganda, and the fact that these things sort of have come to surface at this time. Every now and then I go like, really? That's, isn't that convenient? And at the same time, there's the other part of me that says, kind of how we were talking about, how sometimes you have to go through a process first. I'm, you know, how should I say, from a cosmic plan sort of point of view, I'm also open to the idea that, hey, this is, you know, this is the time we needed it most. You know what I'm saying? And what better time for this thing to sort of be unearthed? Regardless, I just have one. This is not Gospel of Thomas, but just while we're on the idea of these different books, are any of you familiar with the Gospel of Mark, the secret Gospel of Mark?
A little bit.
This is the gospel that that proclaims that has a section in it that implies a homosexual Jesus, and this was something when it was first discovered, the church like praised it as like the greatest thing ever, the greatest archaeological find ever, and then when it was translated, they were like, "Oh shit, this is a forgery." Are any of you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar.
I have not
with
read
that,
that
actually.
One.
Yeah, hey. No.
It's kind of your description of it's kind of ringing a bell, but I haven't actually gone through the whole thing myself.
Okay, yeah, it's worth looking into. It's just a really fascinating thing. It basically implies, you know, actually, if anything, it kind of adds somewhat of a credence to something that you talk about in the Gospel of Thomas interpretation of a tantric interpretation of some of the Gospels, that there's not necessarily an aversion to sexuality, that sexuality can very much be in line with a spiritual practice, particularly within Tantra. And basically the story that's in there kind of imply, I think I'm going to give you the paraphrase version, is that like Jesus goes to this woman's house, her brother is sick, or he's even dead, I think he's sick, and the woman basically offers to have sex with Jesus, and he says, no, no thank you, and then he goes to visit the brother, and then tells the brother to take off all his clothes, and they go into this cave together naked, and then they come out, and then the brother's like dancing around, they're like, what happened? They're like, Jesus showed me the universe, and it's like, what the hell happened there? So,
wow.
But at the same time, you know, there's this idea that the very last logian in Gospel of Thomas, right, you have this idea. He says, Simon Peter said to him, let Mary leave us, as women are not worthy of life. Jesus said, I myself will lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males.
Yep,
for every woman who makes herself male will enter heaven's realm. Well, again, I'm not trying to put my interpretation on this, but just to throw out there, we have a sort of open sexual identity being expressed by Jesus here. We also have other logia that refer to an implied tantra. Again, I'm not trying to throw anything onto your interpretation, Swami, at all. I'm kind of just throwing this out there onto the table to see, is there anything in your reading that, you know, just maybe you can speak to the tantric aspects of what you find in Gospel of Thomas or any of these things as you wish. But I just sort of, to me, it's not really a mutually exclusive, or I don't see much contention between the different sayings that are being said here, if we factor in that other thing.
I would just say that I don't think that the Gospel of Mark you're referring to necessarily invalidates anything that we've already gone over from a yogic, from an enlightenment standpoint. I don't give a shit if a guy says he's a guru and he happens to be an ass man He likes to, I don't care if he likes to fill his ass. It's just totally irrelevant because the person acting in that capacity is inherently must be human or he can't fulfill the role. Otherwise, there's no one for you to fucking talk to. There's no one to tell you the shit that you need to hear. There's no one to show you. Otherwise, you're contemplating the impersonal Brahman, which is another path, and that's valid too. But that's not what the Guru Marga is. That's not what the Guru path is. And the person that shows up to take on that role is going to have a personality, and that personality is not subject to my prejudices.
Huh. This is funny because I, like, you know, I kept thinking of Jesus as a possibility, as more of a composite character that's very reminiscent of Socrates. So there's no historical proof of the existence of Socrates. However, there's plenty of proof of Plato. Whereas with Jesus, you know, it's easier to give an argument for the people spreading the doctrine infinitely easier than it is of this person even existing. While we know that the Messianic movement was a huge movement, and that a lot of people had to suffer the consequences of taking part in that movement in a similar way to Socrates, you know, who's charged with corrupting the youth. You know, very, very similar situation, very, very similar rationalization for submitting to a death penalty. A lot of these things parallel. So I find it ironic then that when someone says that you have a platonic love, the way that we generally take that, whereas, you know, we should know that that had to do with homosexuality. He was intimate with his students. He was in love with his students, like certain students that went on, you know. They tried to downplay it, you know, when they came across these things, you know. They were very close. No, they were really close. I mean, look where we're talking about and the time we're talking about, you know.
Yeah, the historical side, you know, again, you know, there's the historical and then there's this sort of looking at it more as metaphor, but historically it was going on. And again, I don't have an issue with it. I started to bring it up and then I kind of backed away just because I didn't know if that was something you were uncomfortable associating with your teachings or anything. And I was like, well, okay, you know, if you don't want to go there. But I just found a passage I just want to read to you guys real quick, just because I don't know if you guys will actually, or even if the listeners will look this up, but this is Gospel of Mark. It's a really short passage. It says, "And then they came into Bethany, and a certain woman whose brother had died was there. And coming, she prostrated herself before Jesus and says to him, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' But the disciples rebuked her. And Jesus, being angered, went off with her into the garden where the tomb was. And straightway a great cry was heard from the tomb. And going near, Jesus rolled away the stone from the door of the tomb. And straightway going in where the youth was, he stretched forth his hand and raised him, seizing his hand. But the youth, looking upon him, loved him, and began to beseech him that he might be with him. And going out of the tomb, they came into the house of the youth, for he was rich. And after 6 days, Jesus told him what to do. And in the evening, the youth comes to him, wearing a linen cloth over his naked body. And he remained with him that night, for Jesus taught him the mystery of the kingdom of God. And thence arising, he returned to the other side of the Jordan." You know, make of that what you will. I just, again.
That's remarkable. Wow. Just, you know. It really is. But, I mean, to kind of sidestep that issue, I just want to say that you reminded me of another part of the work that we're looking at here, this gospel, the Yogic Gospel of Thomas by Swami A, as we're referring to him for this conversation. You know, you bring up a whole bunch of stuff with the mention of Sophia and the Christos and the Pleroma. You mentioned that. You cover this material as well. You cover a lot of ground in this very impressive work. I got to tell you, Swami, I was really, you're definitely, I feel you've done a really amazing job with this material, and the way you've put it together, and your writing is very, it flows with a very pleasing eloquence. It was a good read, and I liked how you handled the material in a very personal way, but you obviously have great insight and understanding about this work, because it shows through as far as I'm concerned, as one reader of your material. And I was impressed, and you know, it's I'm excited because you handle the same material, the Sophia and the Christos and the Pleroma. We are reawakening these terms, you know, you and I, because I mentioned those in my chapter of the Sync Book 2, and it will come up again in my work right now with the Secret War Inside Freemasonry and other material after. And I mention it, you know, because of my own studies in the Greek Gnostic material, but to bring it all back around, I honestly believe that the groups that we're talking about, the first and second century movements, that I believe that they were steeped in esoteric, Hebraic, you know, Gnostic, proto-Gnostic traditions that trace back in their roots to the Egyptian temple mysteries. I mean, obviously Moses was an initiate by tradition, if we're going to bring another character into this play. I mean, there's a connection there, and the word Essene, by one origin has it, they're those with the light within, and it was thought that Jesus and John and these guys were Essene/Nazarene teachings, that in the Quran they called him Isa, which is by one definition is initiate of Isis, which was connected to the Egyptian mysteries, which is Moses again connected to the Egyptian mysteries as well, and we haven't really touched upon this, but the traditions that arose in the region around Qumran and the River Jordan and all those, the sectarian area, historically speaking, this is all connected to the movements that go back to the prehistoric, you know, BC, the Maccabees, who rose up before 70 AD, you know, a whole couple centuries earlier. The Maccabees were the ones who rose up and took out the priesthood then that was being sponsored by the Greek leadership with their, you know, they basically put an abomination in the temple with the image of Zeus that was just, you know, too much for the Maccabees. And they went out into that same region around the River Jordan and basically took on kind of the wandering pilgrim life, because they swore not to plant orchards or build, you know, permanent structures. They lived, slept on the ground and lived in tents like Bedouins, you know, and so that kind of, in my research, I've sort of come to the conclusion that it was from that fertile ground of these different people that were living like that. They had kind of shrugged off the statism of Jerusalem because they saw the corruption of the priesthood and the defamation of the temple and everything. And the connection there was this idea of let's look back to a more pure time when we were wandering through the desert, you know, with Moses and obeying the law and had the Ark of the Covenant with us. And that kind of gave birth to these revolutionary zealots and others that brought about the end of Jerusalem in the first century and the, you know, the obvious deaths of the various leadership that kind of connected it all back to this dynasty, which was referred to in the Gospels, the family of, you know, Jesus and his followers. They were all connected. I mean, it's all in my mind. That's just how I paint the picture. I'm a generalist, though. I generalize.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, I'm just want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. You're saying that you think that the prophetic tradition of Israel has roots, or is it at least has a history of pulling in influences from their nomadic wanderings and things like that?
Oh, yeah. I believe there was a lot of influence going on. I mean, when my experience with the esoteric orders, the rituals, and the organization and structure of the lodge space and the council areas, like, for example, in a lot of the York Rite bodies, there's a triumvirate that sits in the east. Just like, so there's always this rule of three, which goes back to the Essenes and earlier, and in the Egyptian mysteries, too. There's the structure of the room and the players within, you know, there's always this familiar theme that keeps reoccurring like a perennial pattern, you know, and in that same way, I see the connection, you know, I see the Egyptian mysteries that were the Moses. I mean, there are those who would claim that Moses was Akhenaten. Our friend Freeman has put forth that. Many other people have put forth that idea. I can't really say one way or the other. Lawrence Gardner is another one who talks about it. And, you know, there's a lot of other people so up till now have put forth it. But it comes from that same sort of Genesis of the Grail Kings and all that. And I can't say one way or the other whether that's what Moses was, if he was Akhenaten. But he definitely, according to tradition, Judaic tradition, he was an initiate of the Egyptian mysteries, and the connection with the wandering tribes. In the Masonic tradition, the three key people involved in the leadership of the lodge and council are King Solomon, King Hiram of Tyre, and Hiram of Biff. And these three people represent three traditions of esoteric mysteries, and they bring a syllable of a word that's a three-syllable word, which is the secret word. And so they come together and form the word. And according to the ancient Hebraic tradition, in the time of James and John and all them, James was a high priest, which meant he still had access to the Holy of Holies. And on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies of the temple and speak the word of God as a form of atonement. Only the high priest could do it. And if he wasn't clean, if something was wrong, he'd be struck dead and they'd have to drag him out by the rope they already had tied around his ankle, you know. But the connection there is interesting to me, and it sort of speaks to, and people have written, this is in the research society surrounding Freemasonry and these other appendant orders, people have written research papers exploring the idea that the three-syllable word has representations in the three traditions of the Palestinian tribes around there, and then the Canaanite tribes, and then the Egyptian tradition that came with Moses, and was inherited with King Solomon. And so the three combined was this like ecumenical type esoteric, you know, they all came together according to tradition to build the temple that would be the place where the word would be uttered.
Since we're kind of now we've opened the conversation up to Freemasonry in your area of study, do you relate that to either the Masonic Jabulon, right? This is like a three in one. And then you also have, there's theories that even the name Israel was like Isis, Ra, and El, being the sort of father, son, mother, father, and child. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, that's the whole point, is that there's this triple, it's always this triple theme that keeps getting reoccurring. And every order, every esoteric order that I've come into contact with supplies, you know, key grips, passwords, and especially a secret word, you know, that's usually a triple syllable or otherwise, you know, has that, or double or triple syllable, you know, and that's exactly what it is. It's reminiscent of some sort of philosophical, allegorical, symbolic teaching outside of just the utterance of the word itself, you know. It that's what it's all about. That's what all these esoteric orders are about, is presenting the tools in a way that can be deconstructed and unpacked and then taken on board as a greater teaching, you know.
That's fascinating. I'm not really well versed in a lot of this stuff, but I try to. I'm always really fascinated by comparative religious studies. I haven't even talked to Alan about this, but this whole project, the the Yogic Gospel of Thomas project has sparked an interest in me to kind of go back even farther into the heart of the matter and kind of investigate some of the similarities between early Judaism and Hinduism, for example. And the three-syllable word thing caught my interest because it's I'm sure you've come across the proposal in your own studies, Frater, but Om is a three-syllable word, and I'm not necessarily sure that that contradicts anything that you're saying. And I have the theory that I've come across and that I'm most interested in pursuing further is that at a certain point in time, there was a global culture of Sanatana Dharma, which is the proper term for Hinduism. It didn't really become an ism until English people began to occupy India. And I'm not necessarily sure that means that it was Hinduism in the form that we know it now, but definitely like a definitely an esoteric tradition promoting the recognition of non-duality. And I'm really interested in trying to see how much more info, how much more I can illumine that subject matter. Cause I have more questions really than I have answers about it, but just some of the stuff that you've been saying has kind of struck a chord with me on that whole front.
Just or like even the word, even the name Solomon, you know, Saul, Om, On. I mean, those three there, you got
Shlomo.
They're all, you know, and but yeah, that's the two syllable, right? So the three syllable though, Saul, Om, On are three, right? Each one of those, Sol is the sun, Sol of Victicus, and then Om is the one, you know, and then On is the Egyptian sun. So it's like this theme, right? It's right there, you know, clearly, right? And then, of course, Alan, you made sort of a reference to this. I want to come back to it. I want to be clear about this. When we mention the Essenes and we mention Freemasonry and the structure of the leadership, that's not the only parallel. There's a lot of people who aren't aware that in the 1880s, there was this ritual monitor, a pocket book for Masons that used to be published and went around called The Ancient Order of the Essenes. And it had this little pseudo-history in the beginning of it that talked about the structure of the Essene order and how it was just like a lodge system. And it was really weird. You know, I have a couple copies of them. People have them. They're usually they're in the lodge space. They'll be sitting in the library or whatever. Nobody knows what they are. But what it was is that at that time period in the 19th century in America, it was against the Masonic law to publish the ritual. There was no physical publication. So some lodges would handwrite them and have, you know, their own like one copy of it that they'd make, and it would be issued, or they'd make like a dozen copies and they'd number them and they'd, you know, jealously guard them and strictly, you know, issue them under strict circumstances and all this stuff. But in general, you couldn't publish this ritual. So the Ancient Order of Essenes was created, fabricated. It's basically the Masonic ritual ciphered as a one-letter cipher with symbols that is the Masonic ritual. It is the ritual of the first 3 degrees encoded, and it's called the Ancient Order of the Essenes. So that's a strange connection. Well, here's another strange connection. It's referenced in many of the side orders of Freemasonry that Noah and his sons started the first lodge, and that's the tradition that they picked up from Adam and Seth, who were like learning from the, you know, God in the garden about the celestial lodge. And this is all ancient tradition amongst the fraternal orders, but it all connects to this idea. For example, in the New Testament, it says that Joseph was a carpenter, right? Well, the term is builder. I mean, it really in Greek it's tekton. And Jesus and Joseph were tectons. They were builders, right? Well, that's what Freemasons are called, builders in America, and craftsmen. Well, in Greece, in modern vernacular, in Greek, the Freemasons are called tectons. So it's just a remarkable little aside. I just find it unusual. Like, but anyways.
That book that you were speaking to on the Essenes, are you talking about Edmund, I don't know how to pronounce this, but Bourdieu... It's his last name S-Z-E-K-E-L-Y. Zeekly.
I don't have the, cause I'm actually in Freeman's library doing this broadcast. I'm looking to see if he's got a copy of it on the wall.
There was
here.
A series of smaller publications, including the Essene Gospel of Peace. And
well, no, that's not what this is.
Because you said 19th century America.
Yeah, it's the 1870s to 1880s. It was right after the Civil War time, and it had only a couple pages of a small little short history about the Essene Order, but the entire little pocketbook, it's like one of those little Masonic pocketbooks you can see on eBay, and you could actually probably see this book. I'm sure it's probably on eBay or Amazon, but it's just the ritual ciphered. It's just the entire ritual, opening, closing, and all 3 degrees of the Blue Lodge, of the Ancient Apprentice, Fellowcraft, and Master Mason degrees of Freemasonry. And it's ciphered, so what it is every word is just reduced to one letter. And there's symbols, too, to kind of connotate different little implied conjugations and, you know, allusions that are... It's all part of memory work. You're supposed to be the point was is that everyone had to learn this like an oral tradition. One Mason would teach another through memory, recitation and repetition. And the cipher is a one letter reminder. Just like the different images that you see associated with Freemasonry are all just every picture represents a little phrase, a little memorized little teaching or lecture connected to the ritual that a Mason knows. So when he's going through, it's like a PowerPoint presentation, right? So he goes from one image to the next. It sort of triggers his memory work that he should have already done hours and hours on end, you know,
sure.
Going over the ritual again and again, you know. And so then it just keeps moving like that. But the point that I was trying to make with all this is that there is a belief among the esoteric orders, at least in the fraternal orders in America and in the British Isles, that the fraternity of the Freemasonic system and the Rosicrucian system and all these systems were connected to the sectarian movements of the first and second century, Jerusalem and, you know, Palestine region, you know, the Levant.
All right.
What happened?
Nothing. I just stopped talking.
Oh, I came back and I go, oh no, what happened?
Where's Swami?
Guess what just arrived at my door?
The proof. So right now,
stunned.
Auspicious moment. So congratulations, fellas. Good work.
Yeah. I have the. We'll have to talk later, Swami. The printing looks off. I'm gonna call the printers. I don't know if they're open today. It's New Year's Eve, but I'm gonna try and call the printers and see. There's definitely something off here. It looks like a really strange, like could just be the actual printing, meaning there are some pages where it looks like maybe the ink was running out, or it's possible that they did something for some reason, like boosted the contrast, because the cover is suddenly a lot darker. Instead of being like a bright red, it's a really deep, deep, deep red. And the inside is, a lot of the pages are kind of washed out. I've seen this happen before, and it's probable that it was just a printing error. But then I have to call them and tell them to reset the printer. So, whatever, we'll talk later. Other than that, it looks awesome, but it's just basically they'll have to recalibrate the printer for this. But it's pretty damn nice.
Well, it's progress, at least.
Yeah. So I wish I had a better thing to a better announcement to make in the middle of this year, but I said it looks great. It's just as I'm kind of flipping through it, I see some places where it looks just oddly really washed out, and there's a number of things that could cause that.
So with a little luck, it might be available to the listener by the time they're actually listening to this, right?
Yeah. I mean, we have an option. What I would prefer to do would be to call them and tell them to recalibrate and then have them ship us another one. Obviously, nothing that we would pay for. Say, hey, you guys screwed up. Check your printer, recalibrate it, send me one to make sure. And then just, but that means waiting a few more days to make sure that we have something that looks right.
Let's make sure it looks right.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's funny because the book says December 2013, but you know, whatever, we'll be close.
Yeah.
Hey, Alan.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, man.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I hope all of everybody here has a happy new year. And, you know, I think it's congratulations, Swami, on the book. You know, this is the great time to be starting new endeavors. I've got a few achievements of my own that I'm already accomplished and continuing to accomplish. So I'm excited about the prospects of the new year. I wanted to just point that out to everybody. And, you know, also this being the season, like the whole Christmas time, I wanted to bring up a little interesting aside about this, the gospel traditions and stuff. You know, it's interesting. This is kind of not related to what we were just talking about with the book and all, but I just wanted to kind of put this little cap on things. And then, I do have to kind of wrap it up pretty soon, guys, just for the record, but just an interesting aside, you know, according to the esoteric tradition, the three wise men who show up, you know, in the nativity scene were in fact initiates of one of the oldest orders in the world, an order of profound humility and purity. Some would say the last surviving Eastern esoteric order of any real validity still functioning outside of Judea was the Magi of Persia. And Professor Eisenman, once again, he traces the Johannite or Johannite tradition, the cults of the Sabaean baptizers, all the way to southern Mesopotamia from Jerusalem, from that Qumran, Judea, you know, Jordan region, southern Iraq wetlands. And it's the point that I want to make here is that it's remarkable to me that right there in the story in the gospel of the nativity scene, right, the three wise men came out. And it was actually my wife, Maderex, once again, she pointed this out a long time ago in thinking about it. Isn't it interesting? Because we'd watched that movie Kundun with I think it's about the Dalai Lama, if I'm not mistaken, or it's where they find, they go out and they, the astrologers confirm the avatar, the reincarnation of the master, you know, they go, it's an Eastern tradition, and it just strikes the same chord of the Magi going to the nativity because they bring three items. And in the story of the confirmation of the avatar, they bring items from the old master who has died, and the baby chooses the item, and that is how they know that it was him, right? So it's like, it's interesting to me that this item right laid within the gospel, where in the gospel tradition, America at least, Christians totally denounce anything to do with like astrology or the occult or, you know, anything about Eastern reincarnation or any of that stuff. It's all considered, you know, the devil's work. And yet, right within the gospel story is this clear sort of like nod to the idea that Jesus, the character in the nativity, is this reincarnated master, you know, in the avatar sense in the Eastern tradition. Just a remarkable aside, anyways, fellas.
Totally.
Well, I also should get running very soon here, but just to say, you wished me a happy birthday and everyone a happy new year, but you told me before we hopped on this call that you had just finished typing up your manuscript today, so I want to wish you also a congratulations on that. So here you have a finished draft of The Secret War Inside Freemasonry, and we've been talking about starting working with Sync Book Press for that. You know, I mean this mostly joking, but you should probably speak to Swami here to find out how hard it is to work with me for that long. I could be an asshole sometimes, but I think, you know, that's kind of what the job calls for, is to make sure the book's as good as it can be. I can't wait to, you know, kind of have another like seriously, I really want Swami's book to be out because it's really good. It says a lot about a book that you can read it probably, you know, 15, 20 times and still find it somewhat enjoyable and not wanting to burn the damn thing. And I mean that very seriously. You know, it's like you read something so many times, you go like, ah, I never want to look at this thing again. It really holds up, and it's something that I'm really proud to have put this much time and effort into. And I think, Swami, I think you should be really, really proud of what you have here. So,
I agree.
I am. Thank you, guys. Those compliments coming from you guys both actually mean a whole hell of a lot to me, and I really appreciate it. And Alan, thank you again. The book would not be what it is without you and Jason being there and sometimes being a pain in my ass. So it was a good problem to have in the instances where yeah, I might not have always been thrilled about where we were at in the process. It was always what needed to happen, and again, just can't say enough good things about you guys. And I, in my in my the whole all the excitement about the show, I forgot to wish you a happy birthday. So happy birthday from me as well, and congratulations to you on your on finishing your manuscript, Frater.
Well, thanks. I mean, to be technically clear on this, I'm not ready to give anything up right now, just so you know. It's not technically done in my mind, just for the record. But I do appreciate your congratulations anyways.
Oh, there's another point that I wanted to make that I almost forgot about, but you were complimenting me on my scholarship on the bringing subjects like Sophia and the Christos into the picture, and I have to give all the credit for that to Jason. That was all his scholarship. Almost everything referring to the Gnostic tradition that shows up in that book was new to me at that time. Jason brought all that to the table. I had to go through it and digest it and work it into the book and everything as appropriate, but he really opened my eyes to a lot of things that made the book a lot more just really, really well-rounded, I think.
Oh, yes, I would agree. A great, great addition. It totally does add a dimension to it that I think was exciting for me as a reader, and especially it was timely with what we're looking at right now, I think. And we kind of struck this chord at some. I think Alan brought this up, you know, the time, and David too, about the time right now and the material that we're viewing. We're talking about really ancient stuff, but we're looking at it in a retrospective way from our so-called quote-unquote postmodern, you know, spectacles here. And so it kind of creates its own enlightenment in a way, just as time does sort of things unfold over time and we learn new things about old ideas, you know?
Totally.
Totally, yeah. It's
totally.
Absolutely right, yeah. I think, you know, we're all seekers on this journey here, and, you know, it's really nice to get together and have a conversation like this where we can share notes and kind of see what everyone can bring, something unique to the table. And that's why I really enjoy doing this kind of work, because it's just you get a chance to see a little bit of everything and really get exposed to a lot of fun stuff like this.
Well, that sounds like a wrap to me.
Yeah, indeed. All right, I gotta go meet my wife, guys.
Happy me too.
Wonderful, happy new year. Be my best favor for us.
Thank you.
Retrograde, and so it would make sense that there would be challenges in that way.